On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
If you're worried about the world being on fire, you're worried about how we're going to use our military, you're worried about strengthening our military, and you're worried most of all about keeping your homes and your families safe and secure, you cannot give Hillary Clinton a third term of Barack Obama's leadership.
When I'm President of the United States, we are going to win this war on ISIS. The most powerful intelligence agency in the world is going to tell us where they are. The most powerful military in the world is going to destroy them. And if we capture any of them alive, they are getting a one-way ticket to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and we are going to find out everything they know.
Now we have dirty bombs, and we have cyber attacks. And we have people who will be attacking our electrical grid.
The idea that somehow we're better off today than the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated President of the United States is totally an alternative universe.
The next president's going to get one, two, three, maybe four Supreme Court justices. The court will rule that not a single person in this room has any right under the Second Amendment, and the government could confiscate your guns.
All I'm saying is our next president has to be someone that undoes the damage Barack Obama has done to this country.
We owe $19 trillion. Our country's a mess, and we can't let all these people come into our countries and break our borders. We can't do it.
Well, just some of the zingers lobbed during last night's Republican debate. With President Obama now in the final year of his presidency, many people are taking stock of his record. Obviously, the Republicans hoping to succeed him are focused on the failures. But Michael Grunwald has a different view. He's senior writer for Politico magazine, and his latest story is called The Nation He Built. In it, he writes that the president has led several, quote, quiet revolutions. And Michael Grunwald joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we know the obvious accomplishments that he touts a lot. Obamacare, repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, killing Osama bin Laden, ending the war in Iraq. What are you looking at?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is that some of those big accomplishments, whether you like them or not, are not that well understood. Obamacare, I think people understand, for example, that it extended health care to 18 million people who don't have it. But it's also contributed to the slowest healthcare cost growth in 50 years. And it's starting to transform the way, you know, medical care is delivered in the United States towards a system that is more based on sort of value than volume. I actually led my article with it tucked into Obamacare, which I know a lot of Republicans have described as a kind of government takeover of healthcare, which is not really accurate. But there is an actual government takeover of the student loan system, right? The $1 trillion student loan program, which there used to be run by banks who didn't really take any risk but got tens of billions of dollars in really big fees. Just in this little provision in Obamacare, that's now been taken over by the government. They used the $40 billion in savings for low-income students to give them more Pell Grants. And it's really transforming the way higher education is financed in America. So like you said, I think people know that he bailed out the auto industry. They know there was a big stimulus. Some people even know that there's been a huge transformation of the energy system, where you see solar increasing 2,000% and wind power tripling. But there's also a lot going on behind the scenes in for-profit colleges, as you mentioned, with gays in the military. So much happening that Republicans and Democrats have acknowledged, whether you like it or not, it's a pretty big deal.
Right. Well, let's talk about what you were just mentioning, this addendum to Obamacare and the student loan reconfiguring and forgiving some of that. Student loan debt is a big issue, at least on the campaign trail on the Democratic side, and it is still estimated to be at $1.2 trillion.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you do hear a lot of talk about it, but sort of quietly without anyone noticing, not only is the program now administered by the government rather than these banks, which is reducing these fees, but over the last 7 years, starting in Obamacare, but then continuing through a bunch of rulemaking process, The Obama administration has dramatically reduced the amount of payments that those student borrowers have to make. So now you don't have to pay any more than 10% of your discretionary income, and you can get your loans forgiven after 20 years. It's essentially a massive transfer of that student loan burden from borrowers to taxpayers, and it really hasn't gotten very much attention.
Now, how much of these accomplishments that you've mentioned, how much of these were accomplished through executive action that could be undone by a future president?
Well, in the first 2 years, there were some, I think people recognized when Democrats controlled Congress, there were three really gigantic pieces of legislation. And that was the stimulus, which was not only, helped prevent a Great Depression, but also really started to transform the energy system with the largest investment in clean energy in history. It really transformed the healthcare system from analog to digital with $30 billion for electronic medicine to a lot of other things. Then you had Obamacare, and then you had Wall Street reform, three really big deals. But since then, as Republicans have taken over first the House and now both houses of Congress, you've really seen it done through executive action where, even with divided government, President Obama has pushed these new regulations for the coal industry. We're starting with smog and soot and mercury and then moving on to the famous Clean Power Plan to really try to address the climate problem in through the electrical system. You've also seen it with for-profit colleges, a really significant crackdown that is already dramatically changing that industry. And some of those can be rolled back. But you look at the coal industry, for example, which has already, declined by 20-25% the last few years. These utilities are making these decisions, these investment decisions, that are going to be very hard to reverse. As wind and solar and natural gas have gotten cheaper and through regulation from the EPA, coal has gotten more expensive. So really, it's hard to see how even a coal-friendlier administration is going to revive that industry. So even some of these executive actions, you can reverse the action, but you may not be able to reverse the effect.
Mm. So one of the things that he regrets that he mentioned in his State of the Union was that he failed to win over more Republicans, that he failed to win politically when it came to dealing with Congress in the latter years of his presidency. How do you think that he scores on that? I mean, he himself admits that that is his biggest regret.
Well, look, I wrote a book about the president's first term, and I reported on meetings that Republicans had in December 2008 and January 2009 before he took office, where they really made this conscious, brilliant strategic decision that they were going to oppose just about everything major he did. But in any case, he promised that he was going to bring people together and create this postpartisan nirvana in Washington. And that obviously didn't happen. And that's sort of the clear broken promise of the whole Change We Can Believe In campaign. What I've tried to point out in this article is that, while people focused on, what he was going to change in politics, he was also making a lot of policy promises in terms of transforming education, the environment, energy, healthcare, Wall Street regulation, and those, by and large, he's kept to the extent that you now see Republican candidates like Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio essentially saying, look, this guy has succeeded. We hate what he's done. We want to roll it all back. But let's face it. I mean, this has been a very consequential 7 years. They think it's been a disaster.
Mm. So how do you think he will be looked at by historians? Will he be looked at as an activist president?
Well, absolutely. I think everything we're talking about here is government action. And mm-hmm. there's definitely a belief that the government can kind of make things better. And certainly, while everybody can argue about the results and to what extent, Obama's policies have driven them. You look at when he took over, where the country was losing 800,000 jobs a month, the deficit was over $1 trillion and heading north, and now you see unemployment's been cut in half, we're gaining 200,000 jobs a month, the deficit has been reduced by three quarters. I think sort of the kind of top line, are you better off than you were 7 years ago, He's got a pretty good case to make. The larger question of, are people going to like the way he's transformed education in ways that teachers unions don't like, the energy system in the way that fossil fuel interests don't like, the healthcare system in the way that all kinds of interests don't like, I think those are sort of longer term questions.
Michael Grunwald, senior writer for Politico, thanks for joining us.
Anytime, Madeline.
Coming up, one more piece of unfinished business for the president, foreclosures and Wall Street, who was helped and who wasn't. That's next on Press Play.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, we heard before the break about President Obama's finished business, but the president made a lot of promises during the housing collapse and the subsequent financial crisis, which brings us to President Obama's unfinished business. We talked earlier this week about Guantanamo Bay, Syria, and the war in Afghanistan. Today, housing and the financial crises. Joining me now is David Dayan. He's a contributing writer to Salon and a weekly columnist for the Fiscal Times. Welcome.
Thank you.
And also joining us, Catherine Rampell, opinion columnist for the Washington Post. Hi, Catherine.
Hello. Good to be here.
Nice to have you. Well, David, take us back to 2009 and just after President Obama took office, the days of TARP, that was just approved by Congress, a $700 billion bailout program. Meanwhile, homeowners across the country are underwater on their mortgages, foreclosing left and right. And tell us about TARP and specifically how President Obama tried to use it to bail out homeowners. What was his promise?
Yes, embedded in the TARP program was this set of money for homeowners to help them mitigate foreclosures, to try to give them loan modifications so they could afford their monthly payments. There were supposed to be between $50 and $100 billion that was directed out of the TARP money for that purpose. What we now know is, according to the latest statistics, 7 years later, only $10 billion has been spent. And it wasn't spent on direct cash transfers to homeowners. It was given to mortgage servicers as incentives to get them to try to modify the loans. The problem is that mortgage servicers have all kinds of incentives, including incentives to foreclose over modifications for a variety of different reasons because of their compensation model. So when you put all that into play, it seems like it was a wrong-headed way to go about this, to actually try to go through these mortgage servicers, which were understaffed, under-resourced. They don't own the loans. They only service them. They collect monthly payments. They are and so they just didn't have a lot of incentive to actually help homeowners.
Right. And so, Catherine, meanwhile, the rest of the money went to help out, bail out the banks?
Pretty much, yes. I mean, a lot of that came before Obama took office, right? We had TARP before Obama was actually in office. But yes, there was a massive flow of money into Wall Street to try to stabilize the financial system. And it did help prevent us from falling into another Great Depression. That said, it was very controversial at the time, remains very controversial, in part because some of the money was used to pay out big bonuses. And the money itself, of course, did not do much to curb the kinds of practices and systems that had led to the crisis in the first place.
Okay. And so we'll talk about Dodd-Frank in just a moment, because that was an attempt to rectify that in 2010. But David, was there a moment early on in 2009 where the banks could have been forced to significantly modify home loans in exchange for their big bailout?
Well, there was a program known as Cramdown, which would have allowed bankruptcy judges to modify the terms of first primary home mortgages, which isn't allowed right now. The president, when he was a candidate on the campaign trail, endorsed that, said he would do it, made a promise in a document that Larry Summer signed right before the transition. But when push came to shove, did not put that into the bills that were must pass, the stimulus or TARP. And when that came up as a standalone, bill on its own, it failed because 10 Democratic senators voted against it. Dick Durbin came to a television station afterwards and said, frankly, the banks own the place, referring to Congress. And I think they might have owned the Treasury Department as well, because Treasury was against this cram down idea that would have given homeowners a lot more leverage against the banks to actually have them do right by them.
But was that something that President Obama fought for and lost, or did he not fight?
He didn't fight for it. He didn't fight for it. And that's pretty well documented that he didn't fight for it. And in fact, the Treasury Department would go in and lobby against it with members of Congress. And Timothy Geithner, in his book, talked about how he didn't see that as a good strategy.
But what was the argument then? Because it seems like that's a pretty big, hefty tool to do what the president had wanted to do in the first place, which was help homeowners.
Indeed, it was a hefty tool. But I think the worldview inside the White House at that point was that they had more concern for bank balance sheets than they had concern for homeowners at that point. And their argument would be that if the banks go away, then we're going to have an even bigger problem, including for people who didn't have a home mortgage. That was their argument. I don't necessarily agree with it, but that's, I think, what led to the outcome that you saw.
And Catherine, let's get to Dodd-Frank now. That was signed in 2010, and it was much ballyhooed as the piece of legislation that would crack down on hidden fees and penalties in credit contracts. It would actually prevent a future meltdown of the entire banking system. It would establish new sets of rules that would ban speculators. It went on and on and on.
It did a whole bunch of things. That's
yeah,
right.
1,200 pages or so of legislation that was going to rewrite the financial rules. What happened?
Dodd-Frank passed. There was a big fight over it at the time. You know, the final verdict on what it actually does is to some extent yet to be seen, because there's so much rulemaking and regulation that's required after it passed, and that's still going on. So even though the law passed, to some extent, many of the things that it laid out for, you know, preventing the next financial crisis, et cetera, protecting consumers, those were kind of laid out in broader terms that need to be drilled down in more specific rules and regulations. So some of that's still being done. But we do have a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which, you know, is there to act on behalf of consumers. And I would say that its record so far has been pretty strong, despite attacks to effectively dismantle it and defund it. So, you know, that's on the books. That we have the Volcker Rule, which is this idea that banks that take deposits effectively are not allowed to engage in riskier, what's called proprietary trading, you know, using the bank's money to turn it into a profit to invest. On that, there's an ongoing fight. But yeah, I mean, there are a lot of things that that the legislation did that we've seen the fruits of so far, but much more yet to be determined.
So he promised then that if the banks went under again, there would be no more taxpayer bailouts. That would be it. How ironclad is that promise?
Well, it kind of depends on how you define taxpayer bailouts, right? There are certain things that are that come from Dodd-Frank that effectively tie the hands of the Fed, for example, to participate in bailing out a bank. You know, this stuff can be rewritten. And if a crisis arises, I would like to think that that Congress would act if it looks like the only way to save us from tumbling over the cliff, us as a country, as an economy, you know, involves bailing out a specific institution, that they would actually do it, as unpopular as it is. Because, you know, I guess the point is that there are attempts to prevent these kinds of bailouts, usually by preventing an institution from getting so systemically important that it requires a bailout. But at the end of the day, Congress can do what it wants. Mm-hmm. They can say we've committed to never bailing out a major institution, but when push comes to shove, they're able to create something to try to save an institution.
David, housing values have bounced back in a lot of parts of the country, and prices seem to be higher than ever, especially here in Los Angeles. Why hasn't that helped homeowners who were previously underwater?
Well, it has to an extent, but you have to understand how many people were underwater and the levels at which they bought, particularly in the so-called sand states, the states where the bubble really went very high, whether it's California, Arizona, Nevada, or Florida. We still have a fair number, over a couple million homeowners who are underwater on their homes. That means when they owe more on the home than it's actually worth. And there still is a major backlog of foreclosure, particularly in states that need a judicial sign-off in order to complete the foreclosure. There's still a major backlog. Mortgage companies have had these horrible paperwork problems where they couldn't prove standing to foreclose, so they sent false documents to the courts. That's still being worked out in many places across the country. And, we still are kind of muddling through because we didn't stop this sort of at the source in 2008.
Well, there was the issue of whether banks would write down the principal versus the interest, correct? And the thought was, at least on the part of the banks and maybe on the part of the Obama administration, that if you attacked the principal, then that would really put banks in a tough position.
Well, unfortunately, I think that's generally right. We didn't see a lot of principal reduction in after the foreclosure crisis. And I think that really had an effect on the economy. There was a book by called House of Debt by two people at the University of Chicago, professors, that showed that in these hard-hit regions, when you had these major imbalances, you had this major debt overhang where a lot of people owed a lot of money on their mortgage, they did not end up engaging in a lot of economic activity. They didn't engage in a lot of consumer spending because they were worried about being able to pay for the mortgage. And this had a real economic impact because that debt overhang was so large.
And so, Catherine, does that give some kind of understanding to the fact that a lot of people don't feel the economy is doing better, even though the numbers say that it is in terms of unemployment and the like?
You mean specifically because
a lot of homeowners are still in trouble with their mortgages?
Well, that may be part of it. My suspicion is that the main reason why there's still so much anxiety about the state of the economy more has to do with wages than has to do with asset prices. I mean, home prices have risen quite a bit since their bottom. So even though there are still some people who are underwater, I think a lot of that debt overhang today has been cleared out. A lot of people were foreclosed upon, and one of the advantages of a system that we have in most states in the U.S. versus in other countries is that these are non-recourse loans, meaning that once you lose your house, that's it. Yeah. They can't really come after you for the rest of the value of the house. And in other countries, this debt overhang still very much exists because people have lost their house and yet they're still having to pay for it.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Unfortunately, so much to discuss. Catherine Rampell, opinion columnist for The Washington Post. David Dayan, contributing writer to Salon and a weekly columnist for The Fiscal Times. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. Has the housing crisis left you with unfinished business? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or you can tweet us at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up on the show, it is movie time. We will review some of the latest releases, including a new Michael Bay macho flick about Benghazi.
He invents explosions that didn't exist, car chases that didn't really happen. And, you can't blame him. You want this to be like a big, crazy movie. But I always get worried when people take history from film.
Our Friday film segment after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Another thin January Friday at the movies, but if you like men with beards slowly walking away from explosions, boy, do we have a movie for you. Our critics today are Christy Lemire, film critic and co-host of What the Flick on YouTube. Hi, Christy.
Hi, good to see you.
Nice to see you. And Amy Nicholson, chief film critic for LA Weekly and soon to be chief film critic for MTV News. Hi.
Hello.
Congratulations.
Hi. Thank you. I'm excited.
I'm excited for you. So let's talk about a really exciting movie, Michael Bay's Benghazi movie, because, Oh my gosh. Well, anyway, it's called 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi.
We are overrun.
States under attack.
Let's go, man. States under attack.
Let's go. We gotta move.
If you do not get here soon, we are all gonna die.
You have a U.S. ambassador at risk.
The ambassador is in his safe haven. You're not the first responders. You're the last resort. You will wait.
Okay, Christy, we do know what happens next.
Yes, well, this is Benghazi through the bombastic prism of Michael Bay. So, you know, it is political without ever saying the name Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
I mean, the suggestion from that clip alone is that they were told not to go in and save the ambassador or try to fight off the insurgents. And they're strapped from the beginning for help. They don't have any support and lots of finger pointing. But these six brave dudes with really awesome beards do indeed rush in and try to save the ambassador.
It really looks like you are in a Silver Lake cafe for a minute there. So much facial hair.
But it's not ironic.
Not ironic.
If you know the Silver Lake cafe where there's dudes with beards and muscles, let me know.
All right, so this is along the lines of American Sniper, one of these movies, Amy?
It's definitely in the key of it. I mean, what's interesting about a Benghazi story is I feel like a lot of people don't know what happened at Benghazi. We just know something bad and strange went down. And so you're not going to find out from watching 13 Hours. I cross-checked everything that happens in the movie, and Bay doesn't just have really loud machine gun fire that looks awesome. He invents explosions that didn't exist, car chases that didn't really happen. And, you know, you can't blame him. You want this to be like a big, crazy movie. But I always get worried when people take history from film. And this is another case where I want everybody to take this. In my review, I made a joke that you shouldn't take it with a grain of salt. You should take it with a stick of dynamite.
Uh-huh. Well, Donald Trump is screening it in Iowa, I read. So it's already become a political movie.
But what's funny, though, is that the screening we went to on the Paramount lot, they had propaganda before the propaganda. They had essentially what is like a making of featurette, which you would find on a DVD extra. And they played it before the movie even began. And it definitely poises this film as being truthful. You know, they have the actual soldiers saying, we wanted to get this story told the right way. And we don't want to politicize it. In the opening credits, it says, this is a true story, as opposed to saying based on actual events or a hedging somehow inspired by. This is a true story. So they want you to think this is true.
It even does that goofy thing of having timestamps in the corners when scenes happen that don't actually matter. Like, he's making coffee, but it's 7:42 and we want you to know that.
And this stars John Krasinski from The Office. Bulked up. You don't recognize him in the clips.
It's a little strange. I wonder if he's going to keep the muscles. Is this him auditioning for a Marvel movie?
Yeah, he's been to the gym, clearly. It's strange.
Yeah, maybe he'll be in the next Transformers movie. Another Michael Bay.
Well, he's transformed himself. It's a good start.
Okay. Next up, a sequel, Ride Along 2, starring Ice Cube and Kevin Hart.
All the new dealers in Atlanta are getting supplied through Antonio Pope in Miami. You need to get me something on this guy.
2 days tops.
So get a team together and fix this.
Put me in on it, James. I'm like half cop, half Puma. I'll get in your ass.
Okay, a buddy cop movie. We've seen it all before. Is it funny?
No. Have you seen Ride Along? If you've seen Ride Along, you've seen Ride Along too. It's the same exact movie, except the only slight difference now is that the Kevin Hart character is not a wannabe police officer. He actually has been through the academy and it has probationary status. That's the only difference.
I'm so bummed because I like Kevin Hart. I think he's really funny.
I love Kevin Hart, but the problem is the ride-along movies don't like Kevin Hart because the only joke in a ride-along movie is that Ice Cube's mean to him. And that's it. It's just Ice Cube bullying Kevin Hart the whole time. And if you love Kevin Hart, you're sort of like, Ice Cube, why are you such a jerk? Also, it's weird timing for Ride Along 2 movie because this is a movie where Ice Cube literally plays an abusive cop. He did it in the first one. He was like shooting innocent suspects all the time. Here there's a joke where he slams on his brakes in a car so a suspect in the back seat goes flying.
Ooh.
And so you're like, Freddie
Gray.
You're thinking, didn't you just make Straight Out of Compton? What's going on with your brand here?
Yeah. Yeah. And so Ice Cube, I assume, is not funny in this at all.
Well, it's just the same dynamic that they have, you know, like Kevin Hart prattles and yammers and Ice Cube sort of glowers at him. And the thing is that they might actually have some nice chemistry. They might. There might be like a nice friction between them. But the script is so terrible that it doesn't give them the kind of material to really explore that in a good way.
OK, so if we're saying no to this buddy cop movie, can you recommend one we can rent that'll be actually good and funny?
The Other Guys.
Oh, The Other Guys is great. I mean, and if you like The Other Guys, that actually...
And who's in that?
Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg. And they just teamed up for a film called Daddy's Home a few weeks ago, which nobody saw. But it's almost as good as The Other Guys.
I disagree.
Wow, it's like we're in our own buddy cop movie. You're the Ice Cube now.
Are you the good cop or are you the bad cop?
I'm obviously I'm the good cop all the time. What are you talking about?
I am the bad cop, clearly.
I think you're enjoying your roles a little bit too much. Okay, next up, Benicio del Toro stars as an aid worker in the Balkans in the 90s. The movie is called A Perfect Day.
Please identify yourself.
Aid workers. We are willing to help.
He's gigantic. We have to get it out and clean the well.
You cannot touch dead bodies.
The people here need water.
We can't get the body out. We got no rope.
You need rope? I know where you'll find.
We need to check if the mission still makes sense.
But first, we're going to get our friend out of the well.
You're not allowed.
Says who?
The United Nations.
I don't take orders from them.
Amy, what is this movie about?
This is an absurdist black comedy set in the Balkans in 1994. And it stars Benicio del Toro as an aid worker who just wants to do one simple mission, which is get a dead body out of the well. Somebody in the very first scene has put it there. It's poisoning the only local water supply. The difficulty of getting the bottle out of the well becomes just this absurdist farce where he can't get a rope. Nobody wants to help. There are people who are making money selling water for a ton of money. And it just builds and builds into this ridiculous statement on how hard it is to be an aid worker, where even if you want to do the right thing, you just can't help becoming cynical based on the tiny obstacles you see, even from the people on your own side, even from the UN.
And did you like it?
I really adored it. I have this thing for Balkan black comedies about that time period.
How many are there?
You know, there's a few, actually. And this might be one of the better ones. It was written, or it's based on a book that was written by a woman who worked for Doctors Without Borders. Mm-hmm. So it has that sense of really being there, understanding what it's like to sleep in your Jeep night after night. And there's just all these really great recurring jokes. There's one where time after time they keep running across a dead cow in the middle of the road, and everyone knows it's probably a mine. It means there's a mine to the left of the cow or the right of the cow or the center. And what are you going to do? And this has Tim Robbins playing just the crazy aid worker guy who might just drive straight over the cow and make everybody scream. And it just really worked on me.
Okay. I can't imagine what the elevator pitch was for this movie, but...
I have no... Do you think war is crazy? Let's tell you. I can tell you all about it. But if you are going to see one war movie this weekend, I might pick this one over the bay.
Over the Benghazi one. All right. Next up, something totally different. A French movie about infidelity. It's called In the Shadow of Women, and it stars... French people.
Stanislas Mérard and Clotilde Courau.
Ooh, good.
Très bien.
Très bien. A plus.
Yes.
So what is this?
So this is from a French New Wave veteran, Philippe Garrel. It is in black and white. It is very much a throwback to that style. It's very spare, very direct in the storytelling. It's about a documentary filmmaker and his wife. And they work together on projects. And then one day he decides to go have an affair with the intern at the archives where he's been doing research.
Because he's French.
Because he's French. Really, it does really come out of nowhere. And that's sort of part of the point of the movie is just how capricious people's whims are. You know, like this younger woman isn't prettier or more interesting or smarter. She's just other. And he has an affair. And then the wife also has an affair. And they begin to suspect one another and tensions rise. And it's just sort of about how dumb our decision making is, essentially. It's like it's what they've done is just needless and destructive. And that's it. But it's really, really well acted. I would say it does not say anything new about infidelity or about people's bad marital choices, but it does it with a very disarming directness in terms of style and tone, and the performances are very good.
And it sounds just French, just like
totally.
Where is the Serge Gainsbourg music?
Totally. And the thing is, because it's shot in black and white, it really could take place at any point in time. It feels very timeless. There's one reference to texting, and that's the only thing that places it in the modern day, but it could be from the 60s.
Mm-hmm. All right, finally, time for Oscar rants because, you know, everyone's got one. So we want to hear yours. Amy, let's start with you.
I don't understand how Michael Shannon didn't get a supporting actor nomination for 99 Homes. I mean, just last week, Christy and I were at the LA Film Critics Awards banquet, and he was our number one prize winner.
Really?
I was shocked he wasn't even in the mix.
I had forgotten about that movie, to be honest.
Oh, but can you forget about his white linen suits and the way he just chews all the scenery? I mean, he's one of my favorite actors, so I've just been waiting for him to continue getting that recognition I want him to have.
Right. And in general, are you a fan of the Oscars and how they nominate movies and or not?
Not at all. But I love making fun of them. I can make fun of them forever.
It's good sport.
This is just a year where you feel like they said, oh, we all watch Spotlight. Let's just see how many awards we can fill out in these categories with Spotlight nominations.
Yeah. What about you?
Hashtag Oscars so white.
Yes.
Again. I mean, all 20 of your acting nominees are white. And is there no room for Michael B. Jordan in Creed? Is there no room for Oscar Isaac in Ex Machina or Benicio del Toro, who we were just talking about, in Sicario?
Or Samuel L. Jackson.
Yes.
So many of the great things he did this year.
It's amazing. I don't know how it's possible. And the president of the Academy, Cheryl Boone Isaac, who is black, yeah, even said after the nominations, I'm disappointed in this and we've got to do better. We can't just say we're going to do better. We've got to do better. And it's frustrating. I mean, I don't know who I would take out of those nominations, but there has to be somebody else in the mix at some point. It's all your usual suspects. Kate Winslet, Kate Blanchett, you know.
The Kates.
Yeah.
It seems to be that you need to revise the rules as to who is a member of the Academy for things to change, because isn't that the issue, that the Academy is overwhelmingly white, older, and male?
Right. They have been trying to diversify, and I think it's just a slow process.
Right.
In terms of getting younger and more diverse people in there. But yeah, it's frustrating.
But then does it take away the imprimatur of the Oscars? Does it make it less valuable in a sense, or less important?
They are not reflective of who goes to the movies. Right. Mm. So it's frustrating in that way.
But that's always been the case,
yeah,
hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's true. But Vin Diesel swore that he could get an Oscar nom for the Fast and Furious 7 earlier this year. So I bet he's pretty disappointed. And I think what you said about it being not representative of the movies is exactly right. That's one of the bigger films of the year. Not that it's an Oscar nominated film.
Right.
I want to clarify that. But if we have the two opposite ends of the film industry this year, one is a huge chain that has the most diverse cast in any franchise that we have in the business. And then you have the Oscars. The idea that Vin Diesel thought he could close that gap is wonderful, but this will not be that year.
Right, and they expanded the Best Picture race to 10 spots to diversify, to get blockbusters, to get a movie like Inside Out or Star Wars or Creed or Straight Outta Compton in there. There's room for it. There were only 8 films nominated for Best Picture this year, and there could have been 10. Mm. So,
for me, and I mentioned this yesterday on the show, is Ex Machina. I really love that movie.
Me too.
And it didn't really get anything.
It got screenplay and a few technical things, but Alicia Vikander was nominated for The Danish Girl and not for Ex Machina. She's great in both, but it would have been so cool to see her get nominated for Ex Machina.
I know, you could fill out Best Supporting Actress with basically only Jennifer Jason Leigh
and Alicia Vikander.
But you'll be watching, right?
Oh, yeah.
We have to. We have to tweet snarky things.
We got to tweet. Got to sit on the couch with wine and make fun of it. Yep.
Okay, I'm glad you know your proper roles, you two police officers, police officers of film. Amy Nicholson, film critic for LA Weekly, soon to be chief film critic for MTV News, and Christy Lemire is a film critic and co-host of What the Flick on YouTube, so check that out. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now, Warren Olney is here.
Speaking of sitting on the couch and making fun of it, we are about to enter into the primary process state by state for selecting a president of the United States. We're going to talk about how it all began with Teddy Roosevelt back in 1912.
The primaries?
Indeed. Mm-hmm. And how he used them or attempted to use them unsuccessfully, as it turned out, to get back into the White House. And what's happened since, but they really didn't become the mechanism for both parties to select presidents until 1972. That was the first election when that happened, and it's happened ever since. Maybe it won't happen again. We don't know. But, of course, the presidential nominating conventions have only been that in name. They haven't actually done anything, but it's just possible.
But maybe this time
it could be extended beyond, in part because of the machinations of the Republican Party.
Ooh, behind closed doors.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, well.
Good stuff.
Nice music bed there. All right. Thank you, Warren Olney. That's coming up at 1 o'clock. And before that, the winner of architecture's most prestigious prize builds housing for the poor. We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW radio.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Can the poor have great design? Yes, according to architect Alejandro Aravena. This week, he won the biggest prize in architecture, the Pritzker Prize. He's from Chile. He's 48 years old. And the Pritzker jury cited his innovative work in social housing and in rebuilding cities after natural disasters. In a recent TED Talk, he says he tries to involve regular people in the design process.
participatory design is not a hippie romantic, let's all dream together about the future of the city kind of thing. It is actually not even with the families trying to find the right answer. It is mainly trying to identify with precision what is the right question. There's nothing worse than answering well the wrong question.
Well, here to talk about Alejandro Aravena is Carolina Miranda. She writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times, and she is pretty much the only journalist here in the United States who has seen his work up close, right?
I'm probably one of the few. I haven't met any others who've seen it.
Okay, well, describe it. What does it look like?
Well, he does a variety of stuff. He is known for his social housing, which is the housing for the poor that he developed, developing these series of half houses.
He calls them half houses.
He calls them half houses because Chilean budgets for social housing are so small that part of the conclusion that he came to was, I could build half of a good house or I could build a whole bad one. And he decided that people, the working class, the working poor, can often do a much better job of finishing out a house than he could. So what he devised was a system of building half of a good house, providing a frame, providing the services such as water and gas and electric and sort of a main habitation space. And then over time, these families could then add subsequent rooms and subsequent areas to their houses. And it's been quite revolutionary because it does make for better architecture, more personalized architecture in the long run. I went to visit a couple of his projects, one in Santiago and another one in Constitución in the south of Chile. You just see how people have finished them in these sometimes whimsical and funny ways, with wood balconies, with pitched roofs, adding gardens, adding a bedroom in different colors. And they're much more, I'd say, habitable, personable, intimate spaces than what you think of as, you know, sort of your grim, modernist, blocky, you know, public housing tower.
But that is so interesting because it just is so contradictory to the way most architects work in terms of it's their vision, their design. They are the ones that are building it and they don't want it messed with. And I'm thinking in particular, I mean, the most obvious example would be Frank Lloyd Wright, where he actually designed the furniture in and, you know, said you couldn't move it.
Exactly.
In the various rooms. But here he doesn't seem to have the ego associated with
No,
that.
I mean, it's a lot of letting go of the ego. I think it's also just recognizing what he saw was a certain set of limitations. And for him, the goal as an architect was, how can I work within these limitations? I can work the way we've always worked and still produce crappy public housing, or I can work in a different way and perhaps provide people with a better, you know, more habitable, more personalized space to live. And I think that's what he has done. Now, mind you, apart from the social housing, he's also designed buildings like the Innovation Center at the Catholic University in Santiago. He designed the architecture school for the university. He's designed a medical building. You know, I'm sure if somebody came and added some like crazy pitched roof and, you know, bizarre Italianate balustrades to those buildings,
he would
probably not be that into it.
Okay, so he has two lines of work then. He mm-hmm. has like the big commissions, and I guess wealthy people also hire him to make houses?
He's done some private work. I would say most of the work that he's done is institutional. Uh-huh. So buildings for educational, a lot of buildings for the Catholic University in Santiago, where he went to school and where he taught for a while. And the university is sort of the big architectural juggernaut in Chile that produces a lot of the nation's architects. So a lot of his commissions have been institutional and have been these social housing projects. He's also worked quite fascinatingly in the area of urbanism. He worked on this whole project coming up with a city plan for the city in the south, Constitución, that had been wrecked by the earthquake and tsunami in 2010. And he and a team of architects went in and devised a plan to make the city withstand those types of storms and flooding in a better way. Part of it was removing buildings from the waterfront, planting a forest, putting parks in high flood risk areas so that if and when those areas did flood, they weren't flooding people's homes. So really thinking about the entire sort of holistic space of the city, not just, oh, what can one building do in this kind of complicated mm-hmm. environment?
Yeah. So he's more concerned with cities as a whole than he is with individual buildings. Why is he so concerned with urbanism? Where did that come from?
I think it's a long-running interest for him, sort of the social side of architecture. In Chile, architecture can be a rich man's game. You know, you have to have clients. clients. You have to have connections to get anything built. You know, somebody's going to commission you to do their summer home or their home in the hills. And he, you know, his parents were teachers. He came from, I'd say, a nice middle class background, but, you know, not, he wasn't floating in money. And so he wasn't getting those easy commissions that other architects did. And it even reflected in sort of his early education. When he was in college, you know, a lot of students were thinking about, for their projects, I'm going to design, you know, the summer home. I'm going to design, you know, the opera house. And he was like, I'm going to design a house for a taxi driver. Because I think he recognized early on that that was an area in which architecture was not really focused. Like, things got built, but architects weren't necessarily thinking about how they could improve those spaces. So it's been a bit of a lifelong mission with him.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking about the architect Alejandro Aravena, who just won the Pritzker Prize with Carolina Miranda. Now, Santiago, where he works and is from Chile, is a lot like Los Angeles.
It is.
Topographically.
It is.
So what do you think our architects could learn from him?
Well, it's interesting. Santiago is one of the five Mediterranean climates in the world, along with Los Angeles. It's also a seismic zone, so they deal with earthquakes, and it's Mediterranean scrub. It's the same topography as Los Angeles. And I think what we can learn from Aravena and a lot of Chilean architects working right now is they're doing a lot of really interesting stuff, sort of thinking environmentally, but in really economical ways. You know, in the United States, we have this habit that when there's a problem, we just try to throw technology at it. Like, okay, we want to be environmental. Like, let's build a building with special glass panels that open and close to the sun and, you know, specially fabricated. And it's all very expensive and very high tech. They're doing that kind of thinking, but with concrete and wood and using those materials in ways that are really innovative. Like, he built that very sort of brutalist tower that you see in all the photos that were disseminated with the Pritzker Prize. It's not just a design conceit. He made it so that this concrete shell protects the insides of the building from Santiago's heat and smog, and thereby uses way less HVAC than an average glass tower building would, because it's not being beat by the sun.
So he puts the windows on the inside.
He's got this atrium.
So it's like the Bradbury building,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah. It's actually, the feel is walking in there and getting that rich sense of, like, wood and steel and sunlight is very akin to the Bradbury building, but on a larger scale. And so what they're doing is working with materials in those interesting ways. And I can't think of a material that's more basic and cheap than concrete. You know, they're not having special panels made in Germany, and they're easy to maintain, they age well, and they're very environmental in the sense that they use less energy there and don't require, like, if a panel breaks on one of these fancy buildings, what do? You got to send off, you know, to Germany to have another one built. There, you replace the piece of wood, you replace the patch of concrete. So,
although people do like windows, they do like to look out.
They do like
outside,
to look out.
Not just inward.
Exactly. No, and the building does have some windows that look out. But I see a lot of that in the Chilean architecture is building around atriums, so bringing the sunlight in different ways, or clerestory windows, using Chile is a major wood-producing country, so they can get wood quite cheaply. And so really innovative use of materials that are inexpensive and you know, don't require a lot of processing and maintenance.
Well, here in L.A., we have Rudolf Schindler, who did the same thing.
Exactly.
Many decades ago.
Exactly.
But worked with cheap plywood and also was working along those lines in terms of trying to bring in the light without the heat.
Exactly. Bringing in the air. I mean, they're all very, in Chile, there's not the budgets for air conditioning that there is here. So a lot of these architects are very preoccupied with, how do I bring in air without air conditioning? How do I keep a building cool in summer and warm in winter? And they're doing it all with very basic materials while keeping the expenses of maintaining those buildings down. So I think there's a lesson to be learned. You know, architecture students at SciArc and UCLA, you know, in addition to those trips to Europe, it might be worthwhile to, like, go tour Chile and see some of the stuff they're doing, because it's really eye-opening.
Well, let's talk about the prize itself. This is basically the Oscars of architecture, I guess.
Yeah, they like to refer to it as the Nobel of architecture.
Okay. Right.
But, you know, LA, so it's the Oscars of architecture. It is a big deal. Every year, it's one architect, and they get a $100,000 prize. I mean, past winners have included Frank Gehry and I.M. Pei and Tom Main of Morphosis here in Los Angeles. And one of the criticisms of the prize is that the prize has tended to go to European, American, and Japanese architects. It seems to be this Bermuda Triangle of architecture within which the prize stays. And so Aravena becomes the fourth Latin American to win the prize. So that is a very big deal. He becomes only the second from a Spanish-speaking Latin American country and the first from Chile. So it's a big deal for Chile, which is Chile has a population that's smaller than the greater Los Angeles area. So this is a big deal in Chile. And I think it's important for the world of architecture to look beyond that Bermuda Triangle, to look beyond Japan and the U.S. and Europe, because there are interesting ideas emerging from other parts of the world.
And so what happens when you win a Pritzker? Do you get vaulted into the stratosphere of Starchitects?
I think it depends on the architect. You know, some of the architects, they had very quiet practices before the Pritzker, and they maintained quiet practices after. I mean, I think it probably ups your speaking fees, you know. and it certainly, I think it provides that sort of stamp of international recognition that can keep a career afloat. You know, that architecture is a very difficult profession. It can be difficult to build. It can be hard to find clients who will be willing to sort of undertake a daring vision. And I think what the prize does is says, no, this is somebody whose vision is worth exploring. You know, the big question for the Pritzker now is, in all of its years of giving awards, only two women have received awards. And so every year, I think the buzz is, will this be the year they award the Pritzker to a third woman? And I think one of the names that comes up regularly is Jean Gang, an architect from Chicago. She's quite well known. She's built some very big buildings in Chicago, residential and otherwise. But it's, you know, the Pritzker jury is this curious kind of old world club, and they kind of operate on their old schedule. So you kind of never know.
So it is like the Oscars.
It is a little bit like the Oscars. You never know who the winner is going to be.
Carolina Miranda of the LA Times, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Julie Myers, rounding out the week. Hi there.
Happy Friday.
You too.
And it's a movie Friday. We talked about buddy cop films.
We did.
I asked our listeners what their favorite buddy cop movies were, and our listeners have yet to engage on that, so y'all get to hear about my favorite buddy cop movies, Rush Hour. This is Chris Tucker and Jackie Chan. I love Jackie Chan movies.
That's
so
great.
Much.
Pick.
It is so good. And then also Turner and Hooch, where one of the buddies is a dog. Of course, I love that movie. So anyway, go to our Facebook page, KCRW, press play. Argue with me about the best buddy cop film.
You're just a dog person. That's what you are.
That's true.
I'll vote for Midnight Run. All right. Julie Myers, thank you very much. And Warren Olney, my buddy, coming up at 1 o'clock. So stay with KCRW. Have a great weekend, everyone. A long weekend. And I will see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation, Rick and Suzanne Kane, and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.